Hi, welcome to Practical Wisdom Stories. We're soul searching with Matt Norman. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, Nikki.
I'm so excited to have Matt with us on the show. We've actually been colleagues for 18 years. It's crazy. And you're just somebody I really respect and admire in our organization, and was so excited to have you as a guest because you recently wrote a book. I've got the audio in the Kindle version. Would you show that for us?
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Nikki. There it is.
One quote that you talk about, I think especially is interesting for the tech professionals. There, you quoted from the Journal of Management that humility in CEOs actually had a huge business impact, that it led to increased collaboration, cooperation, flexibility in developing strategies. And one of the patterns of healthy people you talk about is around that ego. So maybe tell us a little bit more about how some of the work that we do on our ego can really transform our businesses as well.
Yeah, thanks, Nikki. There's definitely a lot of research. And from my own personal experience, I've always been more engaged with leaders that are more humble, put themselves to the back of the line, and suppress their own ego for the good of the group. Satya Nadella is an example of that at Microsoft. He's just, from everything I've heard, I've never met him, but I've heard he's such a humble and vulnerable leader, and that's really improved the culture and environment at Microsoft. And when we talk about ego, sometimes we think that ego just means arrogance or self-promotion, which that partially is what it's about. We also talk in the book about how ego is really about trying to advance our own desires or our own agenda. Sometimes we can do that in very quiet and subtle ways, just by trying to promote the image that we want out there that may or may not really be who we are. For example, perhaps we really want to be viewed as a successful person, for example, not because we have because we're full of ourselves or because we want lots of people paying attention to us, but maybe because our parent really valued success. And so as a result, we really try to manage our image, and project this sense to the world that we've got it all together, that we're holding it all together, that nothing's wrong with us. And so sometimes ego can just be about, kind of falsely trying to hold out an image to the world that may or may not be really true about who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. You also talk about how, there's a societal pressure to look strong and keep it together. And, you really are talking a little bit more about embracing some of the messiness, the growth, and the mistakes, which is so refreshing to hear. So tell us more about how can we do that? That sounds, I think it sounds scary to people to say, hey, I think with Brené Brown has also talked a lot about vulnerability, and I think that can be kind of a scary challenge. So what recommendations do you have?
Yeah, well, it is a risk. And I love how Brené talks about it, and also how Patrick Lencioni says that there's two types of trust. There's predictive-based trust, which is where we trust people because they're competent. And then there's vulnerability-based trust, where we trust them because we can let our guard down around them. And, I just have spent a lot of time through my career and my coaching realizing how much human beings are wired to self-protect. It's like the amygdala response in us is always scanning our environment, looking for any threat to our survival. And so we're always doing things, whether it's like in a Zoom meeting like this, we're, looking at how we might appear on the video, and we're, very careful and measured often about our contributions in a conversation. What are people thinking about us? That type of thing. And while it's important to be strategically vulnerable, in other words, I don't think that we should just, open up all of our fears and inadequacies to everybody, but rather that we, when we're in an environment of trust, when there's psychological safety, that we'd be willing to let our guard down and open up despite some of those amygdala, that radar that says, no, don't do it, don't let your guard down. That when we do, it endears others to us and causes other people to realize that they too can let their guard down and be honest and authentic, and therefore we have more vulnerability-based trust.
Oh my gosh, that just happened this week. There's a participant, and we're you know, in the Dale Carnegie session training, and his four-year-old was right there. And he, you know, said to the group, "You guys, I'm sorry, my four-year-old is here. My wife's sick upstairs." And, you know, it's dancing around with his little dinosaur image. And you could see the chat. Everyone's like, "He's adorable. Me too. I've got that. You helped me to feel less self-conscious." And, you know, while he was self-conscious, everyone else embraced it. And so I think you're right. You know, sometimes what we perceive people are judging us, actually, they're embracing us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, thank you for being human, right? Yes. It gives us permission. Kim Scott, who wrote Radical Candor, you may have seen during the pandemic, wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, which I thought was so cool, where she said, you know, that one of the benefits of this pandemic is that we're going to be seeing into people's real lives.
Oh, yeah.
And how that will just lower many of the facades and guardedness that we tend to have, especially in a work context. So yeah, it's a fine line, you know, because there's certainly a line that we can step over where it's viewed as incompetent or unprepared, irresponsible for us to, you know, just if we, you know, if we didn't pay attention to what we're wearing on a Zoom meeting, or if we have no regard for our background, or if we have dogs barking, you know, I mean, obviously there's like a line that we can go over where it may be distracting or unhelpful. I think that's going to be the litmus test, is this going to be helpful for others? Yeah. And if so, then it's appropriate that I let people in on it. If it's going to be a distraction for others or unhelpful, then perhaps I should hold it back.
You also bring a good point about that fine line. And one thing you're really insightful in the book, you mention about the vulnerability and showing emotions, that it's not just showing the emotions and acting emotionally, but how we describe our emotions. So it's leaning more towards the emotional intelligence of that. So tell us more about that.
So this has been a big part of my journey as I've tried to express my emotions, be more vulnerable in relationships, is realizing that certainly vulnerability can be showing emotion, you know, crying if we're feeling moved, for example, showing some frustration in our voice. We should be allowed to do that as human beings. At the same time, I think it's often, going back to what we said earlier, what's most helpful for other people is to know about the emotions that we're feeling, and sometimes showing them too much can actually be a distraction or get in the way. Now, other times it can be helpful. You know, again, people want to see a leader who's moved to emotion, but sometimes it's maybe most helpful to be able to just express our emotion without becoming emotional. One of my the books and areas of study that I've really dived into in the last several years is nonviolent communication. Oh, yeah. This whole concept of Marshall Rosenberg. Are you that right there?
I've got that up with my Satya. You know, I've got the books you're mentioning. Yeah, absolutely.
I love it. And there's so much written there in some of the books that have come out of the nonviolent communication movement around. Orin J. Sofer is actually one of the nonviolent communication authors, thought leaders that I've really enjoyed listening to and reading. And he just talks a lot about expressing authentic emotions and being able to really name your feelings in an authentic way, not in a blaming or defensive way, because he talks about false emotions. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, false emotions is I'm feeling attacked. Well, that's not really an emotion. That's actually a false emotion that's blaming somebody else for what they're making you feel, but rather to say, I'm feeling sad, or I'm feeling embarrassed, I'm feeling confused. So really trying to name those true emotions has been a big part of my journey.
So true. When I'm also an educator with Gottman Methods, the 7 principles for making marriage work. And the same thing, it's like, how do we express it in a way without making somebody else feel defensive? So yeah, you're right on, you know, some of those things are a fine line, and how we phrase things really can make a huge impact. So thank you for that. One thing that you've been vulnerable with me about, and I really appreciate, is that we both have 13-year-old boys. You know, you've got twins and I've got one too. And we've, you know, over the years, shared parenting struggles and joys. And I guess one thing, of course, I'm very interested in the how to win family and influence kids. So what is your favorite principle, and as it applies to parenting?
So right now, I think it's principle number one. Don't criticize, condemn, or complain. Okay. At least in our house. And our boys are great. I mean, they're really good kids. But like a lot of 13-year-olds, they find a lot to complain about. They find a lot to critique. And we established the 3 C's challenge about 6 months ago, where we were finding that there was just too much criticism about complaining about what the meal was that we were eating, or how much screen time they could have, or whether they had to do chores. And so we set up a challenge where if they could go for 2 weeks without any criticizing, condemning, or complaining, you know, condemning like judging other people, that there was a reward for that. And so we got a lot of energy in our household around the 3 C's challenge. And I think it's really important for kids today to just learn to approach the world with a posture of gratitude and curiosity rather than a posture of critique and complaining.
Yeah, thank you. I know it's been a real shift, you know, especially since they're around more, but, and for me too, you know, even though they have daily chores, you know, right now my 13-year-old's on dishes, you know, instead of complaining when he hasn't done it, just the minute to say, oh, this clean kitchen's amazing, you know, and that kind of a thing is just makes such a huge impact as well. Just, catching ourselves. It's so easy to want to, you know, even tell them how to do things the right way. And so, yeah absolutely. What about, you know, I think kind of interesting for you because you grew up with a Dale Carnegie instructor parent as well. So you've got this multi-generation. I'm curious, what's a story from your childhood that was a defining moment that helped develop the character that you have today?
Yeah, you know, one of the defining moments for me came as a surprise because I grew up in a family that my dad was often in front of groups presenting. My mom was on our school board. And so it became a big surprise to me when I realized I had a real fear of public speaking. And that came in meetings where I felt high pressure to communicate in a very fast moving environment, very efficiently and in a compelling way. And I wasn't doing it well. And so I started developing this narrative in my head that, oh, you're not a very good speaker in meetings. You know, you ramble on too much. You're not really motivating people to action. And so when I would speak, I would start to have this tape play in my head. And this is early in my career. And it got to the point where it paralyzed me. I mean, I had physical reactions to it. I would start to get short of breath. My head would get foggy. My palms would sweat in any kind of a meeting. And to the point where at one meeting, I had a panic attack and I literally couldn't keep speaking. Wow. And so, you know, I left that meeting. People were confused why I wasn't continuing to speak. Splashed water on my face in the restroom. And at that point, just developed a terror of going back into a conference room and having to express my ideas because I was so afraid of having another panic attack. I didn't want to bring that reaction on again. And so I called my parents. And at that moment, you know, number one, I think, actually, I remember my dad's mom, who also was involved in the Dale Carnegie business, gave me some tough love, you know, and she said, you know, just basically, you can get through this, like you've got to move through this, which was a different reaction that I had gotten growing up. My parents tried to, in many ways, create a very positive environment for me. And so for me to have to go through this crucible moment without being rescued was very important. And then the second thing is the one sort of life preserver that I was thrown was my dad said, you should take the Dale Carnegie course. Mm-hmm. And it was that point in my life that I really valued it for the first time. I took a Dale Carnegie course in Boston. And, you know, Clark Merrill, he was my trainer, and it was life-changing in terms of just forcing me to face those unproductive thought patterns and being able to be myself in a meeting.
Amazing. Yeah. You and Warren Buffett, I guess, is life-changing, right?
Yeah.
And tell us more about the patterns and maybe summarize a little bit more about the book for us. I think especially, you know, one of the topics, this is about soul searching, especially during the pandemic that you published this book. And so tell us, I guess, first of all, what was that process like for you to be publishing and writing this book in the middle of a pandemic and kind of a crazy period for you?
Yeah, I felt more and more relevant as the pandemic unfolded because it's revealing during the uncertainty and pressure that we're experiencing, what patterns aren't working for us anymore. You know, throughout this process, when I began writing and from my coaching and own life experiences, I've realized that at some point in our life, we develop ways of thinking and operating that at the time are an adaptation to our environment that help us survive or succeed. I mean, every day over our lives, we're repeating the same ways of thinking and behaving in order to succeed or survive. And I think one day, perhaps because of a pandemic or our job changes or our parenting, we realize that those ways of thinking and behaving don't serve us well anymore, mm-hmm. that we're stuck. And so we have a choice at that point. We can either self-confront and grow, or we can remain stuck. And so the process was a realization that, frankly, individuals and organizations have an opportunity to determine whether we're going to embrace a growth mindset and have healthier patterns in terms of how we think, how we relate with others, how we view ourselves, that's the ego part, and then also choices about how we operate, until hopefully those people and organizations that choose to self-confront and grow can experience more impact and joy.
Terrific. What would you summarize as like a life philosophy, that practical wisdom that you live by?
So, gosh, many concepts come to mind. I think central to my life philosophy is that patterns are inevitable, but growth is optional. Mm-hmm. That we all have to make a choice every day whether we will self-confront and grow. And that human beings, we were designed to constantly grow. And I just realized through my own life and through the work that we do, coaching and training others, how common and tempting it is to stop self-confronting and growing in parts of our lives and just remain, frankly, stuck because it's working well enough for us, or the people around us are sort of letting us get by with it.
Yeah. One thing I really admire about you is you're really open about your faith. Tell our viewers a little bit more about how that shapes your leadership style.
One of the main attributes or outcomes of my faith is my identity, my value. At the end of this book, I talk about how our decision in faith, whatever that is, we all put our faith in something. That decision will whisper a verdict into our minds on a regular basis about who we are and what we're worth. Yeah. And for me, based on what I believe, that verdict is that I have eternal worth, mm-hmm. and that I am loved just the way I am, not as I should be. Mm-hmm. And so that actually empowers me not to remain stuck, but in fact to grow, because I realize that I was created with all of this potential. And rather than shaming or disparaging myself for my lack of potential, I am loved in such a way that motivates me to keep growing, but also simultaneously accept myself exactly for who I am right now.
That's beautiful. I have a little drawing that Adam made, and it's similar to that. I keep it in the office, but it's Psalms that says, "Look to him and be radiant." And it's kind of similar, like, gosh, you know, sometimes when I have that self-doubt, who do I think I am to have a talk show or a podcast? I'm like, okay, look to him and be radiant. So it is, you know, it's sort of like the other voice in our head. So thank you for sharing that with us. Show us your book again so we can get it. You guys, this is amazing. Matt is a good person. Skilled in speaking is something that Mr. Carnegie said, and your book is really insightful about the different patterns that we can change and really make an impact in our lives. Matt, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your heart and soul and your character with us and your book. So thanks so much.
Likewise, Nikki, thank you for your dear friendship and for the impact that you're having. And you demonstrate healthy patterns and promote growth to other people. Just grateful for you.
Great.